This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Israel celebrates its 50th birthday and Madeleine Albright tries to prevent the peace process from falling apart, Robert Stone takes a novelist's approach to the conflict in his new book, Damascus Gate. Stone is perhaps best known for his novel Dog Soldiers, which was adapted into the film Who'll Stop the Rain. His new novel is about a freelance journalist who wants to write about the conflict in Jerusalem, but instead of taking the political approach, tracking incidents of revenge and counterterrorism, he chooses what he thinks will be an easier story. He follows the people in cult groups and on the religious fringe. But through following them, he's led into just the kind of dangerous story he thought he was avoiding, a plot to blow up a Muslim holy place. Many of the people this journalist has been following suffer from what has been called the Jerusalem syndrome.
In the Jerusalem syndrome, as it's defined, foreigners, usually Western Christians, not exclusively, come to Jerusalem and are moved to believe that they've been brought to Jerusalem for some cosmic purpose, to bring about divine intention. And or else they come to believe that they are some divine or saintly personage. And you can see them on the streets of Jerusalem in their impersonations, wild-eyed and calling out. There's a special squad of the Jerusalem police which is charged with dealing with them. There's a special hospital, Kfar Shaul, where such people are confined and dealt with until they can be sort of shipped home.
So these are people who are living in the delusion that they're the second coming of Jesus Christ, or they're a saint, or another prophet from the Bible.
The second coming of Christ is a common one, but there was recently, I was told, a Samson. A friend of mine went by the hospital. I just talked on the phone to him, and he told me he stopped by the hospital and asked the psychiatrist who coined the term, "Who have you got today?" And the psychiatrist said, "Well, just a minute, I'll check." But that day they had no famous figures from the past. The worst time they'd had was with Samson, who was in fact pretty strong. but more commonly, it's Jesus Christ.
Were you interested in trying to find where that line is between deep religious conviction and seriously disturbed religious delusion?
I don't know that there is a line. I think, or if there is, the one person who's defined it best, perhaps, is William James, who talks about being twice born. Being deluded about religion is like being deluded about anything else. It's an obsession. It's an obsessive disorder. I mean, to speak of it clinically, it's an obsessive disorder, and one can collect stamps and in a perfectly rational manner, and then one can collect stamps in a totally deluded and frenzied and obsessed manner. So in some ways, it's not different from anything else. As long as somebody really has a grip on reality, no matter how emotionally they may feel, you can't say that they're deluded. The question essentially is whether their hold on reality is lost or not. Now, millions of Christians believe that the world is going to come to an end fairly soon, and the Messiah is going to return, in their view. And according to whether they are premillenarian or postmillenarian, there will be the reign of Christ on earth, and there will be of 1,000 years, and there will be a war between the forces of good and the forces of evil. All this to the rational humanist sounds pretty far out, but the people who believe it aren't crazy. I mean, they're not deluded. When it doesn't happen, if it doesn't happen, presuming that it isn't going to happen, they will simply adjust their belief system accordingly.
Not everyone in your novel who has come to Jerusalem thinks that they're the second coming. I mean, a lot of people are there for many different reasons. In your novel, some are political activists, some are seekers of one sort or another. Many of the people in the book derive their identity from their religion. Their religion just kind of defines who they are and what they want from life. Where did your interest in identity and religion as a source of identity come from? Is this a recent interest for you?
It's not a recent interest. I mean, my characters tend to be, the characters in all my books tend to be shallow-rooted, transient, of loosely defined identity, looking for their connections to the world, looking for their connections with each other. So that, in a way, Jerusalem is a town I would naturally be attracted to, because it's so much about identity. And Jerusalem, in a way, is ruled by texts. It's ruled by people's interpretation of who they are and what they're doing is conditioned by this narrative that they attach to, that they embrace. And it's always seemed to me that I felt a sort of loose attachment to my story, that I always wanted to change my story.
Your personal story.
My personal story. I always felt that wherever authenticity resided, it was somewhere else. If I grew up in New York, then authenticity must be in San Francisco. It had to be where I wasn't. But I wanted it. I wanted to pursue it. Nevertheless, when I got there, authenticity had fled. It was somewhere else. But wherever it was, I wasn't carrying it around. My connection with circumstances seemed ephemeral. I could never really see what connected me to things exactly. And I kept my whole life, in a way, inquiring into the nature of connections between people, connections between place and people.
Not to get sidetracked too much here, but do you think one of the reasons why you're so interested in connection is because you spent 4 years of your early life in an orphanage while your mother was institutionalized for schizophrenia?
Yes, that is certainly one of the reasons. I mean, the first thing you have to do if you're brought up by schizophrenic is you have to decide what's real and what's not. Because if you're a small child and you're in the custody of a schizophrenic person, they're hearing things and they're concerned with things, very concerned, agitated over things that, as far as you can tell, aren't going on. And so you have to break down the difference between what's happening and what's not. What concerns you is what's happening, and what's not happening, whether it agitates your mother or not, it doesn't concern you. That's mom. I mean, she's doing her mom thing, and this has nothing to do with me. I mean, but this is, of course, a separation. It creates a gulf. You really are addressing your parent across a gulf, and this gives you a hunger, I think, for their presence.
Did your mother have religious hallucinations?
My mother did not have religious hallucinations. They didn't take a religious form. She really was not a religious person. She was really something of an intellectual. She was a New York City school teacher, and she finally lost her job for being too obviously crazy. But her delusions were sometimes extremely petty and not worth paying attention to. Rarely did they have any large-scale concerns. I mean, her way of being crazy was not particularly interesting. I mean, she wasn't concerned with plots to rule the world. She was more concerned with what they were up to in the next apartment, or in the one below. It wasn't a very lyrical kind of madness, but it was something that took her away, that I couldn't understand, but of course I grew up to it, so I had to make sense of it for myself.
Does this give you a sense of connection with people who are mad, whether it's a religious delusion that they have or another form?
Yes, I can relate. I think I can relate to certain conditions, psychological conditions, very, very readily, and I can also recognize them. There are a lot of people on the street suffering from various kinds of psychological stress, some of it clinical, some of it not, and I can usually recognize it. It's familiar to me from the range of my mother's repertory.
My guest is Robert Stone, author of the new novel Damascus Gate. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Stone, author of the new novel Damascus Gate. I'm wondering what other forms of extremism you were exposed to during the time that you spent in Jerusalem.
Well, I was seeing the Intifada, and at that time, one of the things that was going on every day was the Israeli army and the border police making a show of strength, and the Shabab, the young Palestinian youth, making a show of strength on their part, enforcing strikes on the merchants of the city. So you had an air of intense contentiousness and a great air of kind of strutting and saber rattling and antler rattling, if you like. But mainly what we saw was an exchange of threats, a constant battle for the upper hand. And what was at stake here was the stones of the city. I mean, the city which the Palestinians were claiming as home, the stones which the Israelis were claiming as Jews, the absence from which was the central part of their identity, something that they were brought up to lament, to the place where they would be next year for century after century, and now they were finally there and they were not about to give it up.
As someone who really understands the importance of story, did you find it particularly interesting to talk to Jews, Christians, and Muslims and hear their different sides of their story of Jerusalem, and also to talk to Arabs and Israelis, to Palestinians and Israelis, and get their different sense of the meaning of Jerusalem?
I got a lot of that. I was always trying to carry water on both shoulders. I was going to dinner on opposite sides of town, or on one side of town, having spent the day on the other side of town, bringing back what I thought were agreeable stories from that side of town, but my agreeable stories never seemed to go over. But people, for example, believed the people farthest from power were the Palestinians, and they believed rumor, as people far from power will do. They tended to believe all sorts of rumors that Salman Rushdie was coming to the city, that Woody Allen had been in town and was protesting the behavior of the border police. All kinds of unlikely things were believed on the Palestinian side of town, because communications were less advanced.
Were you able to get people to see you as a neutral party, which is, I guess, the way you wanted to be seen?
That was the way I wanted to be seen. That was the way I felt, although I felt different ways at different times. I think so. I think people accepted my basic goodwill. I mean, I think I wanted more than neutrality. I wanted to be everybody's pal.
Somehow I get this feeling that you've been to San Francisco in the 60s, Vietnam in the 60s, and Jerusalem in the 90s, and found some very, very similar themes in all three places. Seekers, misfits, drug use, drug abuse.
Well, I think I've pursued those things to some extent. It's not that I've gone where I expected to find drug abuse and alienated people. But let me put it this way. I mean, if you ask me what attracted me to Jerusalem, it was first the beauty of the city. And then, as I got to know the city better, I saw that around the basic contention between Palestinians and Israelis, there had grown up this milieu, the kind of milieu that grows up around all the fever points in the world, of young people, young and not so young people, journalists, international social workers, UN officials, this entire milieu of people who socialize together, who work together, take risks together, party together. Some of the people working in the Gaza Strip and on the West Bank had just come from Eritrea and from Somalia. Some of them had been to every famine and every war since Vietnam. Many of them had a history of traveling from Cambodia to the Caprivi Strip to Eritrea. The young women would decorate their legs with henna in the manner of Somali women. I mean, they would party all night. Sometimes they would stay up 36 hours at a time. They all tended to be tempted to causes. They were idealistic and adventurous. These people, I think, to a novelist, are irresistible. And these were the kind of people I was seeing in Jerusalem. They were the kind of people I had seen in Vietnam and in Central America, following wars, following emergencies, doing good, and also following their own personal obsessions. And I ended up there, too, was not surprising.
And where do you fit into that milieu? I mean, you've been a traveler all your life. You left high school at the age of 17. You were in the Merchant Marines, the Navies. You did a voyage to Antarctica. You've done a lot of traveling in your time.
Right. Well, I don't fit in anywhere. I have no...
You don't fit in anywhere, is that what you said?
No. And no more.
Even
more
with
than,
the people who don't fit in anywhere.
Well, no, there are people nobody would tend to question, you know, what is he doing here? Because nobody exactly knows what they're doing here in any of these given places. It's true. I don't fit in even with the people who don't fit in, I mean, in terms of a task. I mean, I try to make myself useful. In one way or another when I'm in such places. But as often as not, I spend my time trying to stay out of the way.
Did writing Damascus Gate take you any places psychologically that you hadn't been before?
I had to really... yes. For one place it took me was into the Lurianic Kabbalah, which I found to be an absolutely sublime religious vision.
This is a Jewish mystical text.
It's a Jewish mystical text, and it's partly on Kabbalah that my characters, some of whom are involved in this syncretic heresy, draw upon Kabbalah for their doctrine. And, of course, I had to read a great deal about it, familiarize myself with it. It's mostly been written about by Gerson Scholem. And I found that entire concept of the absconded God accorded perfectly with everything I felt myself, what Nietzsche has written, the 20th century theologians have written about the deus absconditus, that feeling of... the God we couldn't get at. In that doctrine, God has absented himself in order to allow the universe to exist. But he's left these shards of light that have somehow to be gathered together and put together, and the balance restored. And possibly then he will come back to us. And I find this not only sublime, but also tremendously appealing in a personal way. And perhaps it reminds me of trying to get at my mother when I was a very small child. I don't know. Perhaps it reminds me of everything I felt about not belonging in any one place or to any one group of people. In any case, it's a beautiful and breathtaking vision of things.
Does that mean that you're continuing to pursue studying Kabbalah?
No.
You got what you got.
I take the question as meaning, will I somehow commit?
Maybe that's what the question was, yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. But I decline to commit. I have always declined to commit. I'm going to keep writing as long as I can. But at this point, I will not commit.
Robert Stone, his new novel is called Damascus Gate. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Stone. His new novel, Damascus Gate, is set in Jerusalem. It's about an American freelance journalist who's writing about people who have been drawn to Jerusalem by the delusion that they're the Second Coming or that they're the incarnation of a biblical figure. Stone is also the author of Dog Soldiers, about a veteran who started using hard drugs in Vietnam and is now entangled with dangerous drug dealers. Sometime in the mid-60s, I guess, you were in the San Francisco area. You were one of Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters in the early experimentation with psychedelia. And for a lot of people, the early psychedelics brought on an enhanced sense of the mystical qualities of the world. And it was a kind of like deeply secular, spiritual experience for a lot of people. And I'm wondering what those encounters with psychedelics did to your sense of religion or
Well, my psychedelic experiences were religious. On acid, I absolutely believed that there was a God, although it wasn't the God that I'd been brought up to believe in. It was a supreme being, and I felt totally certain of it, totally certain of it. But I was never able to take that much beyond the trip. I think there's something in there. I think there's something imprinted inside us that makes us somehow fashion a supreme entity. It's somehow in our primary process that we look out for some supreme entity. I think that's why it appears in states like the acid state.
You wrote an article that I quite like a few years ago about reading on the road for the first time when you were on the road. I mean, you were actually at sea.
Right.
You were on this voyage to Antarctica to continue the work of Admiral Byrd, who had died shortly before this trip. And you read on the road and so identified with this book. And then 10 years later, you met Neil Cassady, who is the real-life character that one of the main characters in On the Road is based on, and he was one of the people involved with Ken Kesey's group. Everybody was experimenting with psychedelics, and you became part of that group. And once you actually met Neil Cassady, he didn't compare that well in a way to the character in the book. What were the differences between reading the book and reading about this heroic character and actually meeting the person?
Well, it's always a bit of a disappointment, either to meet the writer of a book or a character from a book. Of course, it was 10 years later, but by then, Cassady, who is treated as the most hip, as the most perceptive, as the most eloquent, naturally eloquent cowboy hero in On the Road, was an irrepressible speed freak when I met him. I mean, he was mainlining methadrine, he was mainlining crystal meth, and he never ate and he never slept and he never shut up. And he went everywhere with this parrot called Rubiaco. And you'd walk into a room and someone would say, the last time I was in Denver, those pigs had it out. And you turn around and you never knew whether it was going to be Cassidy or the parrot. So it was, Cassidy was a bit of a trial. He had a hammer with which he practiced quick draw contests, and he was always trying to put acid in everybody's food. So if you didn't watch out, if you didn't watch what you were eating or drinking, you'd find yourself on an extended psychological adventure.
Which he would talk all the way through, no doubt.
Yes. Well, you'd be trapped with with Cassidy and his parrot for 13 hours, and you wanted very much to avoid that. But I wasn't surprised to find myself there. But and I guess I knew enough not to be disappointed.
During the period when you were doing psychedelics in the 60s, early on when you were trying it and you didn't know what your reaction would be, were you worried, having witnessed your mother being kind of sick with the hallucinations of schizophrenia, were you worried about the dark side of hallucination and that it might sweep you away into a world in which you would be cut off from reality and perhaps not able to return again?
When I took my first trip, I thought that's exactly what I had done. I mean, there was no way I was not going to take that mescaline. We were all taking mescaline. We were going into town. John Coltrane was playing on Broadway. Lenny Bruce was also playing in San Francisco. We were getting together for a trip to the city. Everybody was taking mescaline. I was going to take that mescaline. Nothing was going to stop me. But once I'd taken it and it began to sweep over me, I immediately knew what I'd done. I'd put myself in the place that my mother lived, and then I would never, ever get out of it. But I seem to have.
Did you go back there?
Oh, I took lots of psychedelics after that for years.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say the last time was sometime in the 70s. I don't have the energy for anything like that anymore.
What got you to go back there after having this really frightening trip, which you thought you would be cut off forever from reality?
Well, I think the fact that I didn't get cut off, the fact that I lived to tell the tale and got back, made me think. I mean, it's one of the things you know, you keep doing it, and you think, oh, now I've gone too far, but you it clears up and you try it again because it's interesting and it's fun and it's of course dangerous.
Did you have good times on it too?
I had great times on it,
mm-hmm.
But nothing is free.
Right. What do you think the final... do you feel like there are consequences that you're still paying from having done that, or the opposite?
I think I took something away, something positive, something that I learned and that I use in my work, and I think I probably paid a price.
What do you think the price was? I mean, what you took away was insight, probably, right?
What I took away was insight and the relativeness of things. The price I paid is perhaps a degree of confidence in the steadiness of the reality around me. I mean, I don't think I'll ever again trust reality not to turn itself into something unfamiliar and strange and grotesque. That's the price I pay. But what I took with me is useful.
I guess that's something you can work out through fiction, too.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I mean, that's where I work it out.
Right, right. Robert Stone, his new novel is called Damascus Gate.